Let's Talk is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to Let's Talk, episode 38, brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network. Howdy all, Father Corey Stika. Welcome to Let's Talk, our weekly SQPN community podcast. Glad you can join us once again. We got two returning panelists, one who was on not that long ago and one who was on, well, a little bit more than that. First of all, Angela, welcome.
Hey there. Glad to be here.
Well, glad you could join us again. I think last time you were on was Halloween time, wasn't it?
Was it? Wow. That feels like a long time ago.
Since then. Because I know you're on because we had a lot of fun talking about Halloween, Day of the Dead and all that. I can't remember if you might have been on since then. I think you might have been on with Joanne.
I think so. Yeah.
Since then, too. So, but it's been a little while. So we're glad to have you here.
Thanks.
And Father Chip is back again. Just a couple of weeks ago, he was here and glad to have him back.
Hey, guys. It's good to be back. I saw the call for a panelist and I said, I have time.
So that's here a good I thing. Am. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in recoup mode, so this is a good time for that. So, well, how have things been going for you, Father Chip, the last couple of weeks?
Pretty good, actually. The healing is going along well, and well enough that I was able to cover for a parish last weekend while a friend was able to get away on vacation, which is always good. And, so it's going pretty well. And I'm pretty happy about that. Hopefully this, like I said, last time, I think, was maybe the spring. I'll be back up there.
That's a good thing. Get back on active duty and get moving.
Exactly.
So, how about you, Angela? How things been going?
Oh, pretty interesting. At home, my husband has decided to go vegan. So that's been an interesting experience of less animal products in our home. And then at work, I work in a Catholic evangelization ministry. So we're putting on a men's conference here in San Antonio on February 23rd. There are a lot of men's conferences happening this time of year, apparently, across the nation. If you have been thinking about it and you are listening to this, why don't you check it out?
Well, very good. We'll make sure to throw in at the end of the show, make sure to throw in a web address where people can check it out.
Sure.
What about this vegan thing? Did he discuss it with you?
Yeah, he discussed it with me.
Oh, thank goodness.
It's partially for health reasons and, having gone to the doctor recently and kind of seeing, the charts and things. And so, sure. So it's been diet and exercise, and I'm very proud of him. So it's
That's great.
Good for him. Yeah, here... Of course, Angela's down in sunny San Antonio, Texas, so she doesn't have to worry about this white stuff that I've been dealing with today. I had to rush outside for about a half an hour or so and snow blow off the walks because we had a good 4 inches of snow sitting there, and I have a funeral after our recording. So I commented to them that I had to come in and defrost before we could start our recording. A little brisk out there today, but life in Montana. I chose to come back here and I love Montana. I actually enjoy getting out there, but it's still kind of a pain to have to get up on a Saturday morning and shovel off your walks.
It sounds like it. Yeah.
So, well, there's a kind of an interesting announcement that came out this week and we want to talk about it. That blessed John Cardinal Henry Newman will become Saint John Henry Newman. I didn't see when. Do you know when they're going to do the actual canonization? Did they announce that?
I don't think they announced that yet. And I bet you it will be probably in the fall.
Could be. They're usually about 6 months or so after they make the announcement that it's going to happen. So, yeah, it looks like
I read it wasn't announced yet. There was no date.
Yeah, so yeah. Right. Yeah, they've accepted the miracle of a... It was a pregnant woman in Chicago who had serious bleeding during pregnancy. And the bleeding stopped and her child was delivered normally. So thanks be to God for that.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
That's awesome, you know. So, Father Chip, why don't we first talk about what's this whole blessed, canonized saint thing all about? You know, so... Well, What did Cardinal Henry Newman have to do to become labeled just a blessed, where he is now?
Well, a blessed is one miracle, I believe, right, Father Corey?
Yes.
I
mean,
yes. So one miracle, you get blessed. Two miracles, you get saint. And before that, you have to have a what they call a life that is, you know, worthy of being called venerable.
Right.
So... he's gone through that process, venerable, then blessed, and then now saint. And it's happened in a good chunk of it during our lifetime, mm-hmm. and it's been interesting to watch that go through. I once took a course on John Henry Newman, and I'd love to say I did great in it, but I didn't because the professor was really tough. But... The one thing that I took away from that class that really stuck with me was that the professor didn't think he should be a saint, A, and B, he didn't think John Henry Newman would want to be a saint.
Oh,
interesting.
Yeah. And he had studied Newman extensively, and so I thought that was interesting. I said, well, why wouldn't you want him to be named a saint? And he said, well, you know... Then the study sort of stops, you know, and people don't necessarily look deeply into the works of the man at that point. Then it's more, you know, about veneration.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, I wonder, though, was this before, when you took that class, was it before or after John Paul II being named a saint?
Oh, way before.
Because I think John Paul II kind of puts the lie to that. I would argue people are very much still studying John Paul II's works in great depth, you know, especially
yes.
things like, you know, Fides et Ratio and Theology of the Body and some of those writings. So
true. And, you know, he's a more current fellow, obviously.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so I think and so many people were affected by John Paul II. Currently still alive, and so I think it's a little bit more, you know, imminent in it to
sure.
say. So
sure.
yeah, I mean, John Henry Newman is, was a 19th century cardinal. He's not exactly, you know,
yeah.
Current.
I mean, by the world of the church, he's pretty recent. He only died 120
oh, yeah.
years ago, 130 years ago. So
right.
And can
but
I just
by,
jump
by
in?
Our short lifespans?
Yeah.
Sure.
When I was when I saw this news, you know, you look at the sort of the secular newspapers that are reporting the story, and they talk about how Cardinal Newman performed these miracles, that he healed these people, and it just kind of like annoyed, like it triggered, it pushed that Catholic button, like, no, mm-hmm. that's not what we believe. And then you go to the Catholic news sources, and they say that this healing was attributed to the intercession of Cardinal
Correct.
Newman. I was like, there you go, right there. So,
I just wanted
to point out that little fact there.
In case there happens to be any religion editors reading who don't understand our religion, which, first of all, why are you a religion editor if you're going to talk about our religion? But, yeah, we don't say that the saint performs the miracle. God performs the miracle. Our Heavenly Father performs the miracle.
Right.
The saint asks our Heavenly Father to do it on our behalf.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You know, that's what we mean by the intercession of the saint. You know, when we pray to saints, we're not worshiping the saints. We're asking for their intercession. We're asking for these people who are alive in heaven to go to the throne of God and say, hey, pray for this. I pray for this person. I ask you to do something for this person.
Right.
And I'm sure they do it exactly like that. Hey, God.
Hey, God. Hey, buddy.
These people are in the
hey.
You know, the heavenly singing the heavenly praises of God. Hey.
Hey. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's funny when you read the secular papers and they talk about Catholic things and you say to yourself, that's not what it is.
Yeah.
And I get that frustration all the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I know you guys do too. It's so funny sometimes. But then while it's funny, it's also troubling because, you know, how many thousands of people are reading it and saying, oh, that's what Catholics believe, when that's exactly what we don't believe.
And it perpetuates that cycle of misinformation. And so, that's a frustrating thing for me.
I read it in the New York Times. It has to be true.
Yeah, no, sorry. Just like saying I saw it on the internet, right? Everything on Wikipedia is 100% true.
So what was y'all's first, encounter with Cardinal Newman? Because for me, when I was a teenager and I was thinking about, do I really want to become Catholic? You know, I mean, I was Catholic, born and raised, but as they say, but when I came to time for my confirmation, I thought, well, what is this Catholic thing? You know, my parents did a good job raising me. But, you know, when you're an inquisitive teenager, you want to look into it for yourself. And that's what I did. And I kept seeing Cardinal Newman's name come up over and over and over again in my research.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I guess, I'm a millennial technically. So I was looking up stuff on the internet. And by then, there was a lot about him and about his writing, especially as a convert. You know, I was particularly interested in why somebody would convert to the Catholic faith.
Right.
So what about you all?
Go ahead.
Well, I think that, you know, when you're growing up and I was born and raised Catholic, and I said, you know, where I was going to apply to schools that were secular, universities and colleges, one of the things I looked for was, what was the Catholic community like? And so at 18, I wasn't, overly concerned about it, but it was something that I looked at. And all of a sudden, Newman centers started popping up. And I remember that's what I looked up, like, what's this Newman Center thing? And that's when I first really heard of him and understood I don't think I understood what he was all about or anything, but that was the first time I heard the name.
Oh, sure. Yeah, for me, it was really seminary is where I really encountered him. I'd heard of him just kind of in passing, but really hadn't looked in depth into anything that he had said or written or anything like that, which is kind of interesting that there is such a resurgence of people wanting to learn about him. I mean, back in the 19th century, at least in English speaking worlds, in especially in Great Britain, of course, where he was from, he was extremely well known. I mean, he was a famous person as an Anglican. You know, he was part of this Oxford movement, which was a movement to kind of bring Anglicanism back to its purest form, which, of course, is Catholicism. But we don't want to go. They didn't want to go quite that far. Cardinal Newman did. He actually realized, and he's got that famous saying about, to study the history, to know the history of Christianity is to cease to be Protestant. Roughly paraphrasing.
Right.
You know, the idea is the more you know about the history of the church, the more you recognize the church was not Protestant until the 16th century with Henry VIII, of course, for Anglicanism and Martin Luther and others. So he really understood his philosophical and theological pursuits led him to realize that you can't be Protestant if you truly understand the church and what it is.
I think that was the thing about him. He was a serious person and he was serious about faith and he was serious about religion and philosophy. And when he started looking into things like the church fathers, which seems to be like the constant point where people start to think about, well, the Catholic Church has to be the real church of Jesus Christ. And that's where I think Newman got it too. And so he started reading the church fathers and he realized, you know, they're right. I'm wrong. And, you know, I got to change.
Exactly.
And interestingly enough, when he did convert, he was, of course, ostracized from his former Anglican friends. But the thing that surprised me the most when I read about him was that the Catholics didn't trust him either, because he was a former Protestant. And so he was, you know, he was kind of stuck betwixt in between, as they say. And he, you know, but he worked his whole life to, you know, try and change that. The other thing that drew me to him was this idea of the oratory and the idea of sort of what we call, what has been called secular priests, quote unquote, living together in community and having a certain apostolate to do certain things, usually at a parish, sometimes a school, a lot of times a school. And what that means, you know, for the so-called, you know, diocesan priest, what does it mean to be in a community like that? Is it religious life? Is it, you know, what is it, you know? And so that's something that I've always been drawn to, you know, even when I was studying for the priesthood for the Archdiocese of Boston. And I just, I continue to be drawn to it. And every time I hear of an oratory popping up somewhere, I think, oh boy, well, that'd be something to be interesting to get in on. And and then I realize, well, I'm probably not going to let you. So keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that is a tough thing for us as we're both diocesans. We're both secular priests.
Right.
And I think we there is a desire for many diocesan priests to have something like an oratory format. And, you know, in many dioceses, they can't support it. You know, I think in my diocese here, I would love to do something like that. But first of all, it'd have to be in a big city. You know, our big cities, you know, what you call suburbs out there in, you know, in your areas. But it would have to be in a city with multiple parishes. It would have to be in a city or, you know, in a place where we could have multiple priests in a large, you know, house.
Right.
You know, and we'd have to have the priest to do that, you know, and we really don't. Right now, we, you know, we struggle with having one priest with multiple parishes. Mm-hmm. And admittedly, you know, like in my case, neither of the mission parishes could support a priest. They could barely support themselves, you know, with mass once a week.
Right.
But, you know, even in towns like Billings and Great Falls, where we're combining parishes, you know, we're clustering parishes or making, you know, absorbing, you know, three parishes into one type of deal. That's always a, you know, kind of a difficult conversation to have the bishop. Yeah, bishop, we'd like to do this. We don't have the priests to do that.
Right. Right. And yeah, and we're, you know, just so people know that are listening, you know, I'm in the Archdiocese of Boston. It's a big archdiocese with a lot of Catholics. And yet still, we're combining parishes and putting one pastor in charge of two and sometimes three parishes. Yep. And so it's not just in the rural areas of Montana where it happens. It's happening in big cities and big archdioceses too.
Yep. Yeah, and they're building these mega parishes that seat thousands and thousands of people for mass. You know, it's just we can't, you know, as much as us priests would enjoy it, would like that communal life. And it is a conversation, like I said, we're having as diocesan priests, we're having within the diocesan priesthood of what role does communal life have? You know, because an oratory is a different environment than the kind of the traditional what people think of priests living in common, which is you've got the pastor and the associate pastors.
Right. Oh, it's, you know, much different.
It's very different than that. It is much pastor and associate pastors really is you've got a boss and his underlings.
Right.
Oratory is much more a community of equals. You'll have a prior or something along that lines, but they're pretty much equals.
I went to London a few years ago and I visited the oratory in London, and it was I didn't get to go inside the house or anything. I was a little too shy to knock on the door. I didn't want to be that guy, you know, that, hey, I'm a priest from America. Can I come in and see your house?
Exactly.
But I did go into their church, and it was wonderful and beautiful. And I saw in places where Newman preached and taught and walked. And I just walked around the church and just tried to absorb it all. And they have a big statue of him out in front of the parish, too.
Sure.
And I'm sure they're celebrating this week.
The
canonization of their founder. And, it, you know, and he wasn't just, you know, a theologian. He was a philosopher. He was a poet. Mm-hmm. He was a fiction writer. He did a lot of different stuff. He was truly what we would call a Renaissance man. And so he had a lot of interests. But and not to mention founder of a university and other things. And so, you know, he was really active in a lot of different stuff. However, not always successful.
Mm. Correct.
Mm-hmm. You know.
And that's the spiritual life, isn't it? You know,
we
work, you know, what is the saying? You know, God doesn't want us to be successful. He wants us to be faithful. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
You know, you're not always going to be successful in everything you try to do. We hope we can. We want to be. But guess what? We're going to fail, you know, and he understood that more keenly than anyone.
Exactly. And I think that's, something. That's one of the lessons that I took away from my brief study of Newman was, you know, we're not always going to be successful in whatever we do, mm-hmm. and you can't let it get you down. You know, I mean, yeah, everybody's human and everybody's going to have a moment of, wow, that didn't work. And why didn't it work? And, you know, you get down a little bit, but you can't let it dominate your life. And I don't think Newman did. I think he moved on and went on to whatever the next adventure was. And, you know, he truly was, a genius. He could do almost anything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because that he is so well known today, or at least becoming more well known again today. And now we mentioned, you know, the education in the Newman Center. Now, Angela, do you have any experience with that at all? Or,
well, so here in San Antonio, because it's a very Catholic city, most of our major universities are Catholic owned, and they have their own, you know, ministry office. So they don't call the centers Newman Centers. But in the public higher ed, you know, establishments, they do have Newman Centers. Actually, when I was brushing up on Newman, I was very interested to learn about his Irish story because I have Irish ancestry. And I think it was like 6 years after he converted, he was asked to be the rector for the University of Dublin. Is that correct? Or University of Ireland?
I think it was
University of Ireland. Catholic University of Ireland.
Catholic University of Ireland. Yep.
So that was very interesting to me because, you know, if you know Irish history, so this happened in 1852, while the potato famine ended in 49. So you think about, you know, and even then the Irish were still under persecution at that time. Mm-hmm. The penal laws were still in effect and they weren't raised until, you know, the 20th century, really. So that was one of the difficulties that he had was he went through and he made all these great improvements at the school.
Right.
And he established houses for people who were, you know, studying to be able to live together and in community. And he, you know, added law professors and whatnot. But at the end of the day, the state would not recognize the degrees from the school. Mm. And so he was frustrated by that. And he ended up leaving and going on to the next thing, as you say.
Right.
I mean, That's a really interesting chapter of history to me. And, you know, we talk about Cardinal Newman a lot in the, you know, the English side of things, but really the Irish side of things is also fascinating. And the fact that the two miracles came from very Irish cities, Boston and Chicago. How about that?
Oh, there you go.
That's right.
Well, that's actually an interesting point is during Cardinal Newman's life, you know, in the 19th century, Catholicism was much more tolerated in Great Britain than it had been before.
Right.
However, that doesn't mean that it was widely accepted.
Mm-hmm.
It was still a second rate religion, if you will, at least viewed as a second rate. It was you could be Catholic, but, you know, to be a real, you know, Englishman, you would be a member of the Church of England, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if, you know, his conversion would almost be seen as a betrayal by, especially the Oxford movement people, by, you know, high society. Because, again, he was very well known. And so high society would want to be around him. And then he becomes Catholic. He's going with those commoners, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, he was definitely distrusted by those he had formerly been friends with, especially, as you say, in the sort of high society or the big shots of that time in England. But he also, like I said earlier, he was distrusted by the Catholics, too, because he wasn't originally one of them. However, I think, you know, when we talk about that time, it's not just that time. I mean, I think of Ronald Knox, Monsignor Ronald Knox. He was an Anglican priest. And when he converted to Catholicism, his father, who was a bishop in the Anglican Church, disowned him. And I don't know, I'm not sure they ever spoke again after that.
Sure.
You know, so that's in the that's in the 21st century, and I mean, I'm sorry, the 20th century.
20th century.
And so, yeah, so you have, you know, up until, I'd say, more recent times, it wasn't, you know, English Catholicism wasn't sort of in an ascendancy, if you will.
Right.
But I think it is now. I think there's a more, it's, England has become more accepting of different and diverse communities.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see it when you go to London. I saw it myself. And, you know, you see all types of religion showed, especially you see a lot of Muslims. And and it's an interesting international city, London. So now, is it perfect? Obviously not.
Yeah.
They have a lot of still have a lot of crime when it's related to religions, especially the Muslims, and, you know, attacks on Muslims, not that Muslims are committing crimes. And so you have a lot of that still. And but it's interesting. I think Catholicism in England now is so much in a different and in almost better place than it was when Newman was alive. And even shortly after his death.
Yeah. And, and of course, you know, if you know the history of Catholicism in England, it's had some very, very rocky times, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, literally the 19th century, as difficult as it might have been for Catholics then, it was far, far, far worse, you know, after, you know, Henry VIII. And if you study the whole, you know, the whole history of the establishment of Anglicanism and all that. And then that's kind of what Henry Newman came into. That's what he kind of sought to enter into and you know, became a priest. You know, of course, we got to mention that, you know, he converted and became a priest, you know,
right?
Because he had been a minister, a priest, if you will, in Anglicanism and converted over. And this was long before of course, he wasn't married. And that's the other thing. He was he was actually a celibate within Anglicanism,
which he felt was the right thing to do as a priest. You know, I remember reading that somewhere. I don't remember if it was the Apologia or something else, but he was definitely said, you know, he thought that was the way that it should be, and which was another, you know, movement towards a more even a more Catholic, quote unquote, Anglican church. And it was a big part of that Oxford movement, although a lot of his pals in the Oxford movement, you know, were married. And but Newman, no, he determined at some point that, you know, that celibacy was important. And when he did convert to the Catholic Church, I mean, you know, as well as I do, those, you know, priests converting like that, they're not guaranteed to be named Catholic priests. And so he was taking a huge gamble, not just with becoming a Catholic, but with having an income of some sort to support himself. He really was putting himself, you know, into a precarious position.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not that he had a another job to fall back on if, you know, he had to go find something. And obviously he did. And, you know, he was actually ordained relatively recent after his conversion. Yeah. So, I mean,
he was,
and I'm sure it was, again, because he was well known, because his writings were out there. You know, he wrote the, you know, the Essay on Development of Christian Doctrine, his kind of his most famous work outside of his Apologia. Apologia being his conversion story, if you will, right. kind of like Saint Augustine's Confessions, you know, that along right. that lines. But the, you know, his essay was actually written originally when he was an Anglican,
right?
You know, mm-hmm. but it was in the work of doing that essay that led him to Catholicism. And I think I remember reading, and you might know better about this, Father Chip, but I thought I remember reading once that when he wrote it, he wrote it from an Anglican view. And then actually went back and said, no, this wasn't correct. This wasn't correct. And revised it because his recognition of as a Catholic that he had put in his biases into his writing.
No, that's correct, Father Corey. He did go back and sort of edit it and update it to, you know, be better in line with, you know, standard Catholic theology. And, you know, that's a great admittance for a great man, who can make, can say, look, I got it wrong and I got to get it right. And
exactly.
I'm not saying he did that, you know, like jumping up and saying, yay, I made mistakes, I got to fix it. But, you know, it does take a big man to admit mistakes and say, I'm going to go back and fix this. And, you know, he has so many works out there. I mean, we talked about those two. But I think, you know, his idea of a university is something that, you know, is important to read. And it goes mm-hmm. back to what Angela was saying about, you know, the Catholic University of Ireland. It gives his idea of what a university should be and right. should be doing. It's pretty interesting. If you have any interest in sort of, you know, what a university, even just a regular university, should be like, I think it translates pretty well. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's some faith, you know, stuff in there that wouldn't. But, you know, I think if you're a Catholic university in this time, in this day and age, you wouldn't kill yourself by looking at that and saying, these are some good ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is interesting. You know, of course, we live in a time where there's a lot of complaints against Catholic universities for not having true Catholic identity, they'll use the phrase.
Right.
And I know that would be a phrase that he would use, because frankly, I think he would be repulsed by the idea. I don't know a lot about his writings, but I would argue that you're Catholic. You don't have a Catholic identity. You are just Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
You know, and
correct.
So yeah, maybe we need to send copies to the different, you know, like Notre Dame, the rector of Notre Dame and others. No, I'm kidding.
Boston College.
I think we could all have a list.
Fordham. Yeah, there's a list. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's unfortunate, because to get federal money, universities have to kind of jump through a lot of hoops, and and they want that federal money no matter what. And so sometimes even our Catholic universities will do things that they shouldn't necessarily be doing.
Right.
However, I think Boston College, which is in my town, went through a period of time where they were really trying to, it almost seemed like they were trying to do away with their identity as a Catholic university. But
right.
But now they're more accepting of that. And at one point, and this is a true story, the crosses, the crucifixes, were taken out of the classrooms.
I remember hearing about that.
Heard about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember hearing that.
But they're back. They've been back for a while. And so it's important to note that that was happening even in our time. Well, we need to, I think Newman's idea of a university is an important work for, you know, Catholic educators, especially at the university level. It's something that they could probably learn a lot from.
Well, excellent. Excellent. Well, Angela, is there anything else you want to share about John Newman?
Well, you know, I'm just excited that we have another English-speaking saint.
Yes.
We will. It's always a treat to be able to read the lives and words of the saint in their own language, you know,
right.
to not have to translate it and to really have that window into their mind and their heart.
Right.
In particular, because Cardinal Newman also wrote poetry, and to be able to get that window into his soul also, you know, some of the British saints that we have were also poets. Interestingly
right.
enough. So we have that, we're continuing that, I guess, British saint tradition of the poets of our church. But yeah, I'm very excited, you know, working in ministry. People love to hear about the saints. They love to hear about the stories of the saints and to hear about how they're relatable to us, and all the more, you know, that we can provide that to people when we have it in their language. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, I would say one last thing for me. I just think that, you know, Newman can be a struggle sometimes, even in English, because because of the density of the work, A, and B, the sort of 19th century
older English.
Mm-hmm. It can be a little dense and it takes a little bit of time. And I would just say, don't get discouraged. Keep reading it, and you'll get a lot out of it.
Oh, very good. It was good points. Yeah, and it's. It is kind of fun when you're reading along, like say in the breviary, and it's like, oh yeah, this is the original English,
right.
Not the not a translation of a translation like we usually have.
Right.
So, well, very, very good. Well, it's a good time to take a break before we move on to our picks of the week. Once again, I want to thank everyone for listening to Let's Talk. We hope you enjoy this podcast and all our SQPN podcasts. Please do like, share, subscribe to our, you know, we post these on YouTube, so you can put it on, you can listen to it there. Of course, you can find it on iTunes, Google Play, all your favorite podcast apps. Please do share this with your friends. You know, let others know if you enjoy what you're hearing. Please share this episode or any of our episodes. We want to extend our reach, and that's the easiest way to do that is if you share the shows that you enjoy. Of course, we've got all our mini shows that if you haven't checked them out, you know, of course, we've got our Secrets of Star Trek, Secrets of Doctor Who, Secrets of Technology, which we've been doing now for about a month and a half and really enjoying that one. Some very interesting topics there. Not getting too geeky, I don't think. I think we stay pretty accessible in our conversation about the use of technology. Like we just had a great conversation, myself and Joanne and Dom had a great conversation on an AT&T advertising campaign from the mid-90s, early to mid-90s, where they talked about what was the world going to be like today and how much they actually got right. That's kind of a teaser to go check out that episode if you haven't, because it's pretty interesting looking back at those commercials and seeing how much they actually predicted pretty well, actually. So check those out. Of course, if you do like what you're hearing here on SQPN, we do ask that you help us, help us with your contributions. We are a nonprofit and we rely on your contributions to keep things going. So much of what we do is volunteer, but also so much of what we do requires, the bills to be paid. So we do have a Patreon site, which you can find at sqpn.com/give. You can go there and then click the link to Patreon. If you give at certain levels, we have gifts for you even. So please do check that out. This week, we'd like to thank some of our Patreons, Billy C., Placid K., Helen O., Michael S., and Eric R. Thank you very much for your support, and thank all those who support SQPN, whether through Patreon or through other means. Again, check out sqpn.com.give to sqpn.com/give to find out where or how you can help us keep going in proclaiming the good news of the Lord and bringing the light of the gospel to our culture. So please do check that out at sqpn.com/give. All right. So now let's move on to our picks of the week. Angela, what do you have for a pick this week?
Well, moving a few years into history from Cardinal Newman, my husband and I went to go see a World War I documentary by Peter Jackson that you might have heard of. It's called They Shall Not Grow Old. And what is so remarkable about this documentary and why it's made over $11 million for a documentary that's pretty extraordinary is that they took old hand-cranked World War I footage and restored it. So they wrote software to be able to I guess you could say heal it or restore it. So much, you know, when you watch old footage, it's jumpy, it's damaged in one way or another. And it's remarkable how they were able to take this footage and make it into a movie that, you know, a lot of times I had to remind myself, wow, this is actual, these are actual people on the screen, because it looked like it was a modern day movie. with they brought in lip readers to be able to tell what the guys in the footage were saying. And then they they would distinguish, okay, this is this regiment, so where did they come from? And then from that area of Britain, they would cast a voice actor to be able to voice those words.
Wow.
Yeah, they did Foley, so you hear all of the sounds that were original, you know, using original artillery and whatnot. Mm-hmm. They colorized it, so it's all in full color. Right. That's why I said, you know, it looks so real, and it is real, but it looks like that is what was happening right in front of you. It is rated R. It's not for the weak of heart.
You really
feel in the middle of the movie, you really feel like you're in a war because there is no narration except for the actual interviews with veterans of the World War One. So you are hearing the actual voices of these men who experienced the war.
Wow.
And they're telling their stories. And it is pretty gruesome at certain points, but it's also lighthearted. It's truly a time capsule of human history. So, you know, I posted on Facebook, I really wish that this were required viewing for every adult. Because it really puts you into the trenches of World War One, and it shows you what war is like, you know? And I think a lot of times we romanticize war. So, I definitely recommend They Shall Not Grow Old.
Well, that's interesting because I think that is a war that's fading from memory, at least here in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, we still think of World War II and we still have World War II vets, although there's not many of them left either.
Mm-hmm. They're fading away into history.
But World War I is kind of being forgotten.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's good that something like this is out there to document it. And of course, you know, there were good thing is we did have the recordings of the, you know, interviews with different veterans of the war. So the history is there. That's great to hear that. I hadn't heard of that movie until you'd mentioned it as your pick. So I'm going to have to go check that out. That sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't wait to see that. Really looking forward to it. Yep. No, pick is also a movie and I recommend it. I think you can get it on demand now, and it's called Free Solo, and it's about, free climbing, El Capitan in Yosemite. It was amazing, an amazing movie, interesting to watch. I'm fascinated by these guys. It's the second documentary I've watched about this. It's the second rock climbing documentary I watched. But this one's different because he uses no ropes. He has nothing. He's free climbing with no safety net. And it is scary at moments, and it's fascinating. This guy, whose name is escaping me, there's something different about him. You know, they did an MRI of his brain, and you see it in the movie, and in the center of the brain where sort of fear and, you know, things like that pop up, they did a test study. His MRI had no electronic signals, like so where the normal person's did.
Huh.
So he was able to handle that fear in a way that you and me and everybody else would be like, this is nuts. What am I doing? And,
yeah.
It was just so fascinating to watch. And it's Free Solo. I recommend it. It's a National Geographic documentary. I'm pretty sure you can get it on demand. That's where I saw it. And I recommend it.
Excellent. Yeah. I don't know if I'll ever go climb a rock like that.
I will not.
You'll just be able to experience it while watching the documentary. Get the thrill.
Right. Actually, that'd be something to watch like on the 3D goggles, you know. So you get
immersion. Oh, my gosh. You'll have a heart attack.
Well, my pick, I'm going to shift from movies actually to an article I read recently and ended up printing out. And it's an article I'd read before because it's actually it's an old article, but it's The Hour That Makes My Day by Archbishop Fulton Sheen. And it's actually an excerpt, speaking of another famous, famous a figure and famous author and so on. Archbishop Sheen wrote this, it's actually a selection from his Treasure in Clay, his autobiography, which I've also read. It's wonderful. If you haven't read it, it's a wonderful story. Of course, it's so easy to read because Archbishop Fulton Sheen is just so easy to read and understand. He's just incredible. But this section is about his daily holy hour. He was, I almost use the word fanatic about his holy hour. I mean, it's just, he got it in every day. And he even talks in this article about where he had to catch a train at a certain time, and he literally was transferring trains and had to squeeze one in, and, you know, things like that. Got locked in a church doing a holy hour when he was visiting somewhere. But he talks about the importance of the holy hour, of spending 1 hour with our Lord every day in prayer. And it's not a long article. I printed it out, and it's like 16 letter pages. I actually printed it out in a booklet format so I could sit and read it while I'm sitting in front of the Blessed Sacrament. It's really an excellent article. I'll print it. It came out on Ignatius Insight, Ignatius Press website, about, I guess, 14 years ago. You know,
oh, wow.
Yeah, this is like an old article on the internet now. But of course, you know, this is still very much relevant. You know, the importance of spending time with our Lord, spending time every day sitting before him. And, you know, we're busy. We're all busy. Priests are busy. Lay people are busy. Parents are busy. Children are busy. We're all busy. We've got our work we need to do. And the point of this, you know, and Fulton Sheen was busy, but he always said, you need to spend time with him. So much of his priesthood, and it's a message for Father Chip and I, so much of his priesthood came out of that 1 hour a day. So much of what he was able to do as a priest, as a bishop, as an archbishop, came out of his work, his time with our Lord. So it's an excellent article, again, not just for us as priests, but for everyone who's Catholic. If you want to go deeper in your faith, if you want to truly live your faith as Archbishop Fulton Sheen did, this is a good article to look at, because it will give you those resources and how to do that. Well, thank you both very much for coming on again. It's always a joy to have both of you on. Angela, where can people find you, especially that men's conference?
Oh, yeah. So the Catholic Men's Conference of San Antonio, you can find us at cmcsanantonio.com. We are filling up, so by the time you hear this, definitely check us out. And if you aren't in the San Antonio region, then look up the nearest men's conference in your area and check that one out. You can find me on Twitter at InspiredAngela.
Excellent. And Father Chip?
Well, I'm on Facebook, of course, like every old person, I guess, is now. but I'm also on Twitter at @chines, at Chines. And I'm there probably more than I'm on Facebook now. But that's where you can find me. And CatholicDigest.com. That's another place where you can find some of the writing that I do for movies and TV and things like that. So check that out, too.
Excellent. I'm Father Corey Stika. You can find me at Father Corey Stika is my Facebook page. FR Corey Stika is my Twitter handle, although I don't get there. I kind of hit or miss on Twitter, but I am there occasionally. And you can find me at my website, frcorey.org, where I post my homilies. And if you have feedback you would like to send to us about this or any episode of Let's Talk, you can send it to letstalk@sqpn.com. No apostrophe, of course, in Let's. And again, our giving site is sqpn.com/give. Thank you very much for listening, and God bless.